This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. It appears the world is running out of water. 50 years ago, we might not have noticed, but space-age technology is being used to study the Earth's aquifers from satellites. These observations show that more than half of the Earth's 37 largest aquifers are being depleted. Those aquifers are a source of fresh water for hundreds of millions of people, and the supply is diminishing at an alarming rate. Many Americans think of this as a third world problem, but it's not just that. When compared to the rest of the country, the American South has benefited from an abundance of water, surface water, but those same satellite observations show that the aquifers of the American South are also endangered. One of our guests today calls the situation quite critical. He is Jay Famiglietti, a senior water scientist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in California and principal investigator of these University of California at Irvine-led studies. And he joins us very early in the morning this morning from the studios of KPCC in Pasadena. Welcome.
Good morning.
You sound very sleepy.
It is early.
It is. And with us by phone is host of PRI's Science Friday, which you hear on WFAE every Friday at 2 p.m., and that happens to be Ira Flatow. Thanks for joining us, Ira.
Hey, you're welcome.
And Bruce Henderson is with us, environmental reporter for the Charlotte Observer. The Observer recently published a four-part series looking at water supply changes across the Carolinas. So welcome back to the program, Bruce.
Good to be here.
So, Jay, Both because of climate change and the serious droughts that have occurred in the West and even parts of the South here in the last couple of years, we've been hearing a lot about water challenges. And I think most of us connected those to a lack of rainfall. That lack of rainfall meant that streams and rivers and lakes and reservoirs were not being replenished. But you're saying that the problem is literally much deeper than that. So talk about the difference between low volume of surface water and the aquifers running dry.
So that's exactly right. I think many of us really think, when we think about water, we think about what we can see. We think about the water in the streams and the water that's stored in our reservoirs. Out west, we look up in the mountains quite a bit, and we look at the snowpack, and we understand that snow is going to melt and end up in our streams and our reservoirs. But in times of drought, like we're experiencing really across the southern tier of the United States, so it's not just the southeast and it's not just the southwest, it's really been over these past couple of decades, we've had a lot more prolonged drought across the entire South. In those times of prolonged drought, we have to rely on the water that is stored in our aquifers, the water that's stored as groundwater. And most of that groundwater is unregulated in many states, and we tend to really abuse it and use it very much like a checking account, or like with making withdrawals from a savings account, but without checking the balance.
Hmm. And that's a great analogy, and I think you used it on I think it was Bill Maher. I can't remember.
It could have been.
And you talked about the reservoirs being like a checking account, and when you go down deep
right
into the ground, that becomes your investment account.
That's right. That's like the retirement account.
Yeah, and you don't want to tap into that until you need to tap into that at retirement. Ira, we have a water scientist who studies this all the time, but you do science shows and have done science shows for a very long time. When did you first become aware that this was a problem?
Well, you know, all you have to do is to go watch the politics of the world. I mean, we're not living in a vacuum anywhere else. And what's most interesting about this is that you begin to realize that around the world, this is happening all over the world, and that sooner or later, water is going to become more valuable than crude oil. Well, oil is dropping like a rock anyhow, but the scarcity of water is going to become a big political issue. It already is in many dry Middle East countries. But we don't tend to think of that so much here in the United States until we start seeing droughts. We see how California is drying out, and now battles over water there are occurring. So as you watch the news, you see that this is something that is it's gaining momentum.
Do you think, Bruce, that most people in the Carolinas understand this problem? Is it mostly we look at the water shortage that we've experienced during droughts as a surface water shortage? Do you think that most people are aware that we are pulling we are depleting our aquifers here?
Not so much on this part of the state, Mike, because we don't get much of our public drinking water from groundwater.
Right.
We do on the eastern half of the state there, and we've already seen problems. There are 15 counties on the coastal plain that's called the capacity use area, where aquifers were being overpumped to such an extent that back in the 1990s, the state said, we have to stop this. They recognized that the aquifers couldn't sustain that level of pumping. And so in a very unusual move for the state of North Carolina, they actually regulated that groundwater and said you have to have a permit to withdraw large amounts of it, and then you have to use less and less of it over years, so that they were relying more on rivers in the eastern half of the state than they had in the past.
So where in the world, because I said in the beginning that most of us in America think of this as a third world problem, and clearly it is not, but where in the world, Jay, are they pulling groundwater at copious amounts on a regular basis?
Every continent, and some of the greatest rates of groundwater depletion occur in northern India, in particular northwestern India. That's water that's been fueling the green revolution there for decades. Ira mentioned the Middle East, and really it's all across the Middle East. In China, around Beijing, the North China Plain, in northwestern Australia, much of that is probably tied to mining activity. In southern Africa, also probably tied to mining activity. In South America, the big aquifer in Argentina is called the Huarani Aquifer. And then, of course, in the United States, in the Ogallala or the High Plains Aquifer, in the Central Valley, in California, and even in the Coastal Plain Aquifer in the Southeast.
And in fact, because California grows so much of the nation's food, that with their ongoing drought, they have been pulling groundwater for farming. And that presents a really big problem, because the land is sinking as a result of pulling all this groundwater.
That's right. One of the unforeseen consequences is what we call subsidence. It's really much like letting air out of a tire, deflating a tire. And when you pull air out, the tire deflates, it flattens out. And the same thing in some places happens with water. And in California, in some places, it's happening at rates that are as great as 2 feet per year.
And that's 2 feet from top to bottom, but that spreads out over a large area underground, because these aquifers go for miles, don't they?
That's right. And so what we end up seeing is what we call these bowls of depression. And when you map them out, they take up a significant amount of surface area. Hmm. And of course, any infrastructure that's located on top of that, whether it's ironically a water aqueduct or canal or a road or a bridge, of course it sinks, and so it's causing a lot of infrastructure damage in especially in the southern half of the Central Valley.
Now, you are the senior water scientist with the NASA Jet Propulsion Laboratory, and that may confuse some people. Why is an organization that's looking outward to outer space also looking down on our water, and you're using satellites to discover the depth of the problem with aquifers? How?
Right.
Why?
Right. Right. Well, so first of all, the first part of the question is, why NASA? Well, NASA builds and launches satellites. NASA is the space agency.
Right, of course.
And it turns out that when you turn those satellites around and you look at the Earth, they can reveal some incredible amounts of new information about how the planet is working and the rates of change that we're currently experiencing. So we're sort of uniquely poised to be doing this kind of work. The satellite that we use to monitor groundwater changes actually is a different it's a different sort of animal. It really works like a scale in the sky rather than a satellite that might take pictures, an optical satellite. And so as it flies around, basically the greater mass on the ground because of a flood or the lesser amount of water mass on the ground because of a drought or because of groundwater depletion exerts a greater or a lesser gravitational tug on the satellites, moving them literally up and down in their orbit just a couple of millimeters. And so by measuring very accurately the position of the satellites, we can keep track of the regions of the world that are gaining or losing water mass.
Now, you told Leslie Stahl of 60 Minutes that at first you thought this was nonsense. that this wasn't going to work.
That's true. Yeah, right. It's true.
Why does it work? Because you've discovered since then that it does, in fact, work. Why does it work?
Right. It works because it really gets to the huge volumes. So it's physics, and the physics and the chemistry, they don't lie. And so it works because the amount of water that are moved around the planet naturally or by humans are so great that they affect tiny variations in Earth's gravity field, and those are now measurable. We've been measuring it for decades because of the space program, and we just have refined our capabilities over the decades.
If I might jump in for
sure.
A second, there are movements in Congress by conservatives who do not want NASA to use their satellites to look down on Earth. It has to do with a larger issue of global warming and whether you want to allow NASA to collect data about climate change. But there are conservatives in Congress who say, you're NASA, you should be looking out into outer space and not using your satellites to observe Earth. And if they get their way, who knows what might happen.
As an observer of science and scientists, what's your reaction to that kind of a comment?
Well, it's micromanaging science like I've never seen it really micromanaged before. People used to say Congress people used to try to understand what scientists are doing, but really not micromanage what they're doing. But now that ball game has changed.
I mean, it's clear that we know more about the moon and about Mars than we know about the undersea topography on Earth, because NASA has been sending manned flights and satellites and other unmanned probes out into the outer space for years. Wouldn't it behoove us to know more about the Earth? And if we can do it from outer space, doesn't that just make sense to do it that way? How much do we know about the aquifers, really?
In a general way, our exploration of the world's aquifers has been quite limited, and it has to do with the fact that water doesn't have the value that it should. Population hasn't been as big as it is today, so many of our aquifers have not been explored the way they would have been if they were oil reservoirs. The satellites have allowed us to really understand the rates of depletion around the world in a way that we just couldn't do from ground data. So the contributions of satellites to understanding what's happening with the world's water supply have just been phenomenal.
So we're going to talk when we come back from the break about how quickly these aquifers are being depleted and how quickly they might be able to be refilled if we have enough water to do that with, among other things. We're talking to Jay Famiglietti, senior water scientist at the NASA Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, Ira Flatow, host of Science Friday, and Bruce Henderson, environment reporter for the Charlotte Observer. We're coming right back.
Support for this rebroadcast edition of Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the USC Darla Moore School of Business Professional MBA program, offering an MBA degree for working professionals in Charlotte for over 9 years, moving to new classrooms in the BB&T Center in early summer 2016. Details at moore.sc.edu/Charlotte. And the Corkscrew Wine Shop in Bar, located in Brookdale Village in Lake Norman, offering wines from around the world, live local music, and craft beer on tap. Relax, uncork, unwind. The Corkscrew. Details at thescrewcrew.com. Student assignment is a hot topic as CMS continues the process of drawing new attendance zones for schools. The ongoing conversation over pupil assignment has raised tensions, emotions, and heated debate in the community and on the school board. Charlotte Talks is hosting a special public conversation about school assignment tonight at 7 at McGlowan Theater, and you're invited. Hope to see you there. Details at WFAE.org.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Wisconsin primary, analysis of results, prospects for Donald Trump's path to the GOP nomination, and the delegate battle ahead between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Jay Famiglietti is the senior water scientist for the NASA Jet Propulsion Laboratory and a professor of Earth Systems Science at the University of California, Irvine. He's part of this whole effort on the part of NASA to study aquifers from outer space using satellites and gravity. Ira Flatow is with us, the host of Science Friday, which you hear here on Fridays at 2 p.m. and Sci-Fi Matinee on Saturdays at 1. And Bruce Henderson, environment reporter for the Charlotte Observer here. Ira, you've done a weekly science show. I'm not sure how long. What, 40 years?
We actually just started our 25th year.
Okay.
This month.
And we keep hearing that Americans don't understand science and that schools don't do an adequate job of either teaching it or inspiring young people to learn about it. Is that part of the problem here with water?
Well, I think it's part of an overall problem of understanding and trusting science and how to judge good science versus bad science. I believe that we teach science the wrong way. I'm not an educator. I just someone who's been, you know, was one of these geeky kids in high school with the pocket protectors and slide rules and things, and watched the whole thing. It was part of the space race of the 60s where they pressed everyone into learning science. And as I went through school and went through engineering and college, it became obvious to me that we teach science like we expect everyone to be scientists. We don't teach you how to appreciate science. They teach you what the periodic table is for and how to use it, but we don't teach you why you need to know that. Mm. When you're a chemist, you'll get to know that. You'll get to understand that. I think in this day and age, we need to teach science more like we teach music, more like we teach art, if we're still spending money to teach those things. And that is how to appreciate it. We know you're not going to be Yo-Yo Ma as a musician. You're not going to be Van Gogh as a painter. But we teach you to understand and appreciate what they do, how they do it, and why it's valuable to that art and music is valuable to society. We should be teaching science, I think, that way. How to appreciate science. What does science do for ourselves? What does it do for our economy? Why science is so important for developing new products? What value does science have to society? Who are great scientists? Why were they great scientists? Why when you look at a flower, and Richard Feynman, the great physicist, used to say this: when I look at a flower and I have a discussion with my artist friends, they can see a flower, and they look at the beauty of the petals, the colors, things like that. But I can appreciate it even more because I can appreciate what goes on inside the flower to make it function. And I think we need to teach, science understanding that not everyone's going to be a scientist, but that how vital science is to our community, to our life, to our world. But, and then you can understand why you have to worry about the aquifers.
Right. Hey, do you mind if I jump in here, Mike?
Sure.
I think that's a great point, Ira. We take very much a bottom-up approach in the sciences, studying the fundamentals. And those of us who end up being scientists, you know, so that ends up being quite valuable. But the vast majority of us don't. And so what you are suggesting really is a method by which we use case studies, right? Pull out important case studies, pull out important historical figures, and study the science that way. I think that's a great idea. I agree with you.
But you know, we all love our smartphones and our computers, and we've used the internet, and we watch television, and we are the recipients of great strides in medical science. Why don't we appreciate that? That all of that came from science.
Well, because we don't know what scientists do. People love science. Don't get me wrong. People love science. I can tell from my career, we can't talk enough about science. People will eat it up any way they can on our show, on our website, other places, on the internet. There are websites about science that get 30 million views, you know. But they don't know what scientists do. They haven't the slightest idea how science works. What is it like to be a scientist? They know only who Albert Einstein is, but, you know, they don't know why he did what he did. And that's the part that we really have to stress a little bit more.
That one of the questions that I get very frequently is exactly that: is what do you do? How do your science? Do you sit around and think all day? Are you analyzing satellite images? Are you sitting there with a pencil? Of course, the answer is all of the above. But you're right; people don't really understand what we do.
So let's talk about what you do and how these satellites measure the groundwater aquifers around the world. You talk about having these two satellites who are really. They're looking at each other and their relative orbits, and they change by millimeters depending upon how they are pulled toward the Earth by a gravitational pull that increases when there's a bigger mass. And that mass in this case would be a lot of water underground. And so that causes one of these satellites to dip a little lower in orbit, and the other satellite notices that, and then you can tell from that, if I'm understanding this correctly, that there is groundwater under there.
Right.
So
right.
That I think would be a relatively recent technology. How old is your baseline? How do you know how quickly these aquifers are being depleted? And if they're being depleted at a faster rate than maybe 10 or 15 or 20 or 30 years ago when this technology didn't exist?
Right. So that's the challenge, that the satellite only launched in 2002. So we have a solid 13 years or so of data. And so that's our baseline. And everything that we're looking at is relative to that time period. So from the satellites alone, it is impossible to say what happened before. Although when we look at some of these trends in the major aquifers, they're quite linear, which means that they're pointing very directly at what's going to happen in the future unless we change our behavior. Mm-hmm. And so we have to rely on ground-based observations to understand what's happened before the satellites launched. And we have those. We just don't have those comprehensively. And so we put together the best picture that we can. It's a little bit more spotty, but this is, you know, it's not a new phenomenon. It's just that we can track it very well now.
So how quickly are these aquifers being depleted, and how quickly could we refill them if we can refill them?
The greatest rates of depletion are happening in places like India and the Middle East, and these days actually in California. And now we're talking about, in terms of cubic kilometers, which is, you know, a scientific unit, you know, we're talking about on the order of tens of cubic kilometers per year. To put that in perspective, you know, Lake Mead in the western United States holds about 30 cubic kilometers of water. So, you know, we're draining a third to a half of Lake Mead every year in some of these aquifers. Mm-hmm. So that's a vast amount of water.
Is there any way to know if this has happened in our past and that these aquifers were depleted in the past perhaps and then refilled over time? Is there any way to know that?
Right, right. Well, we can always look at the historical record and the paleoclimate record and understand periods of drought and relatively wet periods and relatively dry periods. That's not going to tell us specifically what's happened with our aquifers, just the persistence of drought versus flooding and, you know, whether there's any kind of recovery. But I want to get back to this point of can we refill the aquifers? Mm-hmm. And the answer is in many cases, no, because we are using more water than we have available to us on an annual renewable basis in many places around the world. That's why we're dipping into the groundwater. And so, you know, unless we change our ways and only use what's available to us on an annual renewable basis, then we will continue to deplete the aquifers.
And by that you mean we use the surface water, not
That's
the...
That's right. We use the precipitation. We use the rainfall and the snow melt that ends up in our rivers that we trap in our reservoirs. You know, we're well beyond that point in many parts of the world.
But then if you have this situation like we've witnessed in California with severe drought, which has resulted in no snowpack and rivers drying up and the need to pull from the aquifer to irrigate agricultural products, and this is happening in other places around the world, what do you do? I mean, you just shut down the state of California and say everybody move out because there's no water here?
Right. No, we don't want to do that. So let me answer that in a couple of different ways. One, we need to really manage what's going on here. And we do have new legislation in California. The problem with that, if there is a problem, I mean, it's great that we have it, but the downside is that it will take over two decades, it'll take over 25 years actually to fully implement. So my fear is looking at these trends that I see from space, that there won't be any groundwater left to manage. But that's on the books now, and that's happening. I think the bigger thing for scientists is to be able to provide information to decision makers that can help us understand how much water we have available to us and how we can allocate it amongst its competing uses. Yeah, we have to grow food. I mean, we all have to eat, but we have to produce energy. We have to supply our municipalities and our metropolitan regions. Of course, we have to leave water for the environment. And so right now, those are political decisions, and we need to inject some science into the process.
So, Ira, of all the topics that you talk about on Science Friday and that you've talked about for 25 years on various programs, where do you put water in terms of its importance as a problem that we face?
It's a huge problem. You can hear Jay talk about it. It has bounced around in different places. But I think Jay has put his finger on a large issue about of which managing water is sort of a little branch of, and that is how do you get the governments to make long-range planning and decisions? We've on Science Friday in my career have watched this. You know, the only real success story I can point to about a multi-administration success of getting people to cooperate together that the public really is aware of. Well, there are a couple of them. One is probably the our interstate highway system. You know, that people say Eisenhower invented, but he didn't. He just implemented some ideas that were around of creating the interstate highway system. It took many, many years to do that. The other one is probably the space race. They get to the moon and back in 10 years, which went through a few different presidents to make that happen. The question is, how do we now, given the political climate in states, in the government, in federal government, how do we tackle a problem that's going to take a generation or more to solve? When we have all these conflicting political ideologies happening that will not allow it to go from one administration to the other. And this is true of the groundwater problem. This is true of water management. This is true of climate change. This is true of rebuilding cities, of our infrastructure. I can go on.
Yeah.
And, you know, and this is the real challenge that we face is how do we tackle big problems now? And I don't have an answer for that.
So we know about climate change deniers, and we've talked about that on this program many thousands of times. But what about aquifers? Is it more difficult? Is it easier to prove that the aquifers are being depleted? Is there any argument over that?
No, there is no argument, and so it has allowed us the fact that you can see that there's no snow in the mountains, and we can look at data from groundwater wells, and we can see the ground subsiding, and we can see the streams being depleted. We can try to pump a well or turn on a faucet in some cases in California and have actually no water come out. Makes it pretty hard to deny. So we're on firmer ground. But still, there is most of the water law in the United States is extremely old. It's arcane. It's antiquated. It doesn't fit our current understanding of how the water cycle works. And so that's a big problem now. The governance is it's hard to change that. It may take... I mean, it could take a century to change that.
Well, Jay, can I ask you a question about that?
Yeah, sure.
I mean, how much of the water, I mean, and this is when I talk about big infrastructure problems, how much of the water that we use gets just lost in the system?
Mm. Yeah.
You know, and
that varies.
Pipes and things.
Right. Yeah, it varies from city to city. You know, you've probably seen the stories about L.A. and the rupturing water mains. In fact, the water main in front of my house, I live just outside of Pasadena, ruptures on about a monthly basis. So, you know, estimates can be greater than 50%.
Hmm. And you know, there's back here and back east. There's talk about that there are still water pipes that were made during the American Revolution.
Yep.
That are still being used, carved out of mm-hmm. hollow logs,
right?
And you know that's funny, but it's true.
I know it's crazy.
And, you know, and so this is the kind of big infrastructure. If you're going to talk about keeping the aquifers, you know, at least alive for a while longer, maybe one way to attack that is to attack it by fixing the water system, and that takes a lot of money.
Yeah.
That's a huge problem.
It does, and we know that it's not sexy, right? We've seen the stories about how infrastructure, improving infrastructure is just not a sexy thing for a politician.
So, well, it should be. So, Bruce, recently in Charlotte, there was, I'm told, a water main that had been in use for 100 years that they replaced because it was 100 years old. How big a problem is that in our part of the world? Do we have a crumbling water infrastructure? Are there a lot of leaks? Are we losing a lot of water in the system?
We are losing a lot of treated water, water that you've gone to the expense to make clean and potable to drink. We counted 19 systems in North Carolina that lost one-third or more of their water. They didn't know where it went. It went through leaky pipes. It went through inaccurate water meters. They couldn't account for it, which means they lost money on it, and they had spent money to treat it.
But let me ask this question. Maybe this is a stupid question, but if we have these leaky water systems all over the country, perhaps all over the world, where a lot of treated water is just leaking out of those pipes and back into the ground, isn't that replenishing the groundwater?
Sure. Absolutely. And in many cities, that's actually counted on as part of the water supply that the groundwater will be recharged by that. But Bruce's point is a good one, and that is we've wasted a lot of money treating and transporting that water. So right, we've wasted energy. We've wasted actually water to produce the energy, just so it can leak out.
Water is still not priced as it should be. We don't pay what water really costs. And the true cost is in doing the maintenance and doing the efficiency studies, things like that, that there is so much pressure politically in North Carolina to keep water rates low, including in Charlotte, that sometimes that money just isn't invested.
And water has traditionally been abundant in North Carolina, at least in most parts of the state. Although we have been hearing about the Catawba River being put on the most endangered rivers list in the country. When we come back, we're going to talk more about that with Bruce Henderson, environmental reporter for the Charlotte Observer. We're also talking with Jay Famuglietti, senior water scientist at the NASA Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, and Ira Flato, host of Science Friday. More in a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Carrie Fry Interior Design, providing commercial interior design services in the Carolinas. Celebrating Sea Level, a new Carrie Fry designed restaurant in the Hearst Building, Uptown. Details at cfidstudio.com. And the 2016 Wells Fargo Championship, held May 2nd through the 8th at Charlotte's Quail Hollow Club. Tickets available at wellsfargochampionship.com. Coming up next at 10 o'clock on The Diane Rehm Show, results from the Wisconsin GOP and Democratic presidential primaries. The Wisconsin primary, analysis of the results, prospects for Donald Trump's path to the GOP nomination, and the delegate battle ahead between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders. That's The Diane Rehm Show today at 10 here on 90.7 WFAE. Back to our encore edition of Charlotte Talks in just a moment.
This week on All Things Considered, the water crisis in Flint, Michigan has caused many cities and towns to examine their potential lead problems. Lead in pipes, paint, gas? Why has lead been used for thousands of years?
The lead industry liked to call lead the useful metal. It was adaptable to just about any commercial purpose.
We ask why we once loved lead on All Things Considered. Listen every afternoon.
Weekdays from 4 to 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Jay Famiglietti is the senior water scientist with the NASA Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena. He's with us from the studios of KPCC in Pasadena. Ira Flato joins us. He's the host of Science Friday. And Bruce Henderson, environment reporter for the Charlotte Observer. You began a four-part water – you've done a four-part water series in the newspaper, Bruce, and you started on the banks of the Catawba River. You're a native. You grew up along that river, and you it's become one of the most endangered, overtaxed rivers in the nation. It's an engineered river. We've created dams so that we can generate power and so that we can have recreation, so that we can have the drinking water. Has that negatively impacted – the fact that it is a engineered river, has it negatively impacted us, or has it really saved us from ourselves because we have created reservoirs from which we can draw?
We are lucky to have the reservoirs. I'll say that out first. We are lucky to have 11 big reservoirs that are pools of water that cities and towns can draw water from, and they get us through a lot of situations that we wouldn't otherwise. The Catawba River would not be much of a water source for the Charlotte region if we didn't have the reservoirs. So there's that. There is also sort of the trade-off where you're saying we're going to make a publicly traded corporation. We're going to give you management control of our public resource.
That would be Duke Energy.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And they got a new license last week that was for another 40 years. That's an awful long time, but it shows that in the engineering world and in the water world, things are on a decadal sort of planning basis. But it is good to know that that relationship exists. It is good to know that it's benefited us in a lot of ways, but it also creates expectations for Duke Energy.
We've had several droughts here in recent years, and I guess the most severe was a couple of years ago when you could visually see that the Catawba River was so low. They closed boat ramps. You couldn't get into it. And at one point, the intake valves, or the intake pipes, these huge pipes that draw water out for drinking water, were endangered of being above the level of the water, and therefore there'd be no water coming into those pipes. Have we adequately prepared for water shortages in this area?
On the Catawba, I think we've done a decent job of that. Duke Energy, because they have all their power plants that just gulp down water, nearly 4 billion gallons a day, just on the Catawba River. It's a lot of water. They put most of that water back into the river, but they still lose about 68 million gallons a day, which is about two-thirds as much as Charlotte uses in a day.
And that goes where?
Into the air. It goes into the air as they're cooling the steam. You lose some water into the atmosphere, so it's just gone. The molecule still exists, but not where we can use it. We're lucky to have the reservoirs. We have the relationship with Duke Energy, and we have taken steps since the last drought that you mentioned. A new water strategy came out last year in which they recommended things like lowering the water intakes in lakes so that you could use them when they are at low ebb. And they're now saying we think we can stretch our water supply until about 2100.
That's not far away.
It's not that far away. It's better than the previous study, though, Mike, that said 2050, which is even closer.
Now, Duke Energy, particularly, we talked about this with them during the periods of drought, where they said that they were trying to be really good stewards of the water and try to manage it so that they could still generate electricity using the water, they could still maintain recreational use of the water, and they could still maintain enough drinking water for the Charlotte region. And they're really controlling that by how they control the lake levels, et cetera. Are they, in fact, good stewards of the Catawba River?
You will find plenty of detractors from Duke Energy for various accounts. When lake levels are low and your pier on your lake side house is – you can't get a boat into it, you don't like Duke Energy at that moment. When flooding occurs on Lookout Shoals Lake or some of the others that are flood-prone, you don't like Duke Energy at that moment. But it is really a hard ballet that they're doing here. They're moving water down a 225-mile system. They have to maintain adequate levels in every reservoir. And it's when there's a lot of water, that's a challenge. When there's not much water, that's a challenge. And you have to remember that the reservoirs were not built to supply drinking water. Most of them were there for hydroelectric energy 100 years ago, and water withdrawals for drinking water purposes was an afterthought.
Now, you wrote about something in this series of articles that Jay Famiglietti alluded to just a few minutes ago, and that is that we have antiquated water laws in America. And you wrote that North Carolina and Alabama are the only two southern states that still cling to classic water rights, which have their roots in medieval England. They grant rights to use water to landowners. Any water that goes over their land, those landowners can use that water. What is the implication of that, and what have other states done to change that?
Most states have some system of permitting where if you want to withdraw a lot of water, let's say 200,000 gallons a day or 1 million gallons a day, you have to go to the state and you get a permit. What the permit does is give you a legal right to that water, whether you are a riparian owner, which means water crosses your land, mm-hmm. whether you are that entity or not. In North Carolina, there has been a recent lawsuit in which the city of Greensboro and several other communities built a new lake, Randleman Lake, and they flooded it. And then they got lawsuits from people downriver who owned small hydroelectric power plants who said, "You're taking our water." And guess who won? The hydroelectric plants won.
Wow.
The communities of Greensboro and others had to pay $2 million to settle the case. What that had was a chilling effect on other municipalities who were thinking about building reservoirs to get through the next drought. And they're wondering now, if we don't have legal rights to that water and clear legal rights, we don't have a permit to do this, we can go to court again and lose.
So clearly, we need to have water laws that are modern and that take into account the depletion of the aquifers and the growing of populations and the need to produce food. What is causing, Jay Famiglietti, what is causing the aquifers to be depleted? Is this a recent phenomenon, a modern phenomenon? Is it because of population growth? Is it because of agriculture? Is it because of mining? Why is this happening?
It really is a human phenomenon. And so it's really the last three things that you mentioned. So it's the population growth. It's the agriculture is the big user. Far and away, the biggest user for groundwater is agriculture. We need to eat. So we need to come to grips with the amount of water that we actually use. And yeah, we're using more for mining these days. We're using more for fracking. And people don't recognize that mining takes a tremendous amount of water. The other thing that is going to be a huge issue, and I was thinking of it while you were talking about Bruce. During flooding, people really appreciate the Duke Energy, and during times of drought, and low river levels, people are not so happy. That's really going to be much of the future of North Carolina because of climate change, because of the increasing variability of what we call the hydrologic extremes, the cruel seesaw of the frequency of flooding and drought. So it's not a good time to be a water manager.
Wow. You have said, Jay, that we need to know about the health of our aquifers and that we need to explore the world's aquifers as if they had the same value as oil reserves. We need to drill for water the same way that we drill for other resources. So let's unpack that. You're saying that we need to drill for water so that we can know how much there is, or because...
Exactly.
Okay, not because we want to extract it, just to figure out how much we have.
No, right. I mean, it's... You know, I come at it from I've come at it from a sort of top down, literally looking using the satellites, and we can see what's happening with the rates of change, how quickly these aquifers are being depleted. And so the next obvious question is, when are we going to run out? How much water is actually there? And when you unpack that, you realize we don't really know.
Well, if we can see it from outer space using your satellites, why do we need to drill?
No, we can only see the rates of change. We can't tell the absolute amount. So what we see is that, you know, this southeastern coastal plain aquifer is losing X, millimeters of water per year, which when multiplied, when you convert it to volume, it becomes a significant amount. So really, we can't answer the sustainability question unless we know how much, right, how much is in storage. But, you know, that being said, the signs that we have crossed these tipping points are all over the place, meaning we've got subsidence, we've got depleted rivers, we've got increasing pumping costs as the water table falls and increasing cost of drilling wells. And so we're, in a sense, already in a heap of trouble. That's the situation we find ourselves in.
If we understood the condition of the aquifers and how much water they had left, could we, would we use that information to move people out of areas that face a severe shortage, perhaps a never-ending shortage of water, before the supply went to zero?
Well, that is an excellent question, and it's one that we have to come to terms with. I think in the long term, the answer could be yes. A lot of it really depends on what we choose to do with food production. Are we going to try to keep it in California, in which case we'll run out of water? Are we going to distribute it across the country? Are we going to have will we see more greenhouse agriculture, say in North Carolina? My working hypothesis these days is that metropolitan regions are sustainable and food production is not. So that's where we need to focus our energy.
Well, we've built cities in the desert Southwest that have no natural water supply, so we bring it in from other places. We in California, where the drought has caused all kinds of problems, they're still growing almonds. And God knows I love almonds, but almonds require an enormous amount of water, far more than broccoli or string beans. So is there talk of cutting down the almond trees?
Well, there is. I mean, there's always the discussion about should we be telling farmers what to grow? And we've certainly resisted that in the United States. It's a free country. I think the answer lies in if we know how much water we have, then we can better allocate it. I can, if I'm the governor, I can allocate it to you and you can decide what you would like to grow with it. Areas that doesn't get enough attention in terms of water use is animal agriculture and beef production. So, the almonds get a bad rap, and they are using a lot of water in a time when we should be using less. But we don't really talk enough about how much water is used to grow alfalfa to feed cows.
And we don't talk enough about the relationship of the light switch on the wall to water, because every time you turn the power on, you're using more water.
That's right, and that is not well understood. And I wonder, Bruce, if people understand that in California.
Yeah. I'm not so sure they do.
In North Carolina,
it's hard to not think about that.
Yeah. But and Ira, I'm sure you've talked about this, but I mean, we have all these devices now that require power, and the little brick chargers that we have, if you keep them plugged in, they're always using power, even if you're not, as I understand it at least, even if you haven't got your phone attached to it, it's still taking power.
But we have plenty of green energy alternatives we could turn to if we really wanted to make that extra power. There's plenty of solar energy around. There's plenty of wind energy around. In fact, there are states in the Midwest, Iowa, whatever, that have become some of the greatest green energy sources in the country. You don't even think about it. From the wind, we have Texas, certainly for sure. We have California creating solar energy, centralized solar energy. So, you know, there are solutions here, that depending on our political will of how to do these things.
Well, it seems that North Carolina is in the perfect place geographically for wind power, at least out on the coastal areas we are. And solar, we have a good deal of sunshine here, so solar is a good bet. But there seems to be, Bruce, correct me if I'm wrong, a lot of resistance to both of those things here.
I'm not sure it's a lot of resistance. I think there is a lot of political resistance in Raleigh. There's been a concerted move for the past 2 years to roll back renewable energy tax credits, which happened in this session. The second move has been to freeze or roll back the renewable energy portfolio credit, which is kind of created a marketplace for renewable energy in the state, and some conservatives believe that it is too expensive and that it's a subsidy that is not deserved by the green energy developers.
Hmm. Well, you know, they used to say that in Iowa also. There's so much wind power in Iowa now, and a lot of it is due to these tax credits. Whether any politician now dares come into Iowa and say, let's roll back these tax credits.
And that's exactly what happened in North Carolina, where solar advocates and some of the, even conservative legislators sort of look at all the jobs this is creating in North Carolina. And it's hard to get around that.
I got a minute left, and we have one of our listeners, Tim, in Providence Plantation. My understanding is that we have a fixed amount of water on Earth for millions of years. If we now have a shortage in aquifers, where has the water gone?
That water is moving around in the world. Some of it's being deposited at high latitudes and in the tropics, and the rest is ending up in the ocean. But you're right, we're not losing water.
Okay. And are your findings being used, Jay, by governments around the world?
Not as much as they should be, and that's why I'm on the radio with you folks this morning.
Well, I hope we had an impact, but I seriously doubt it. Jay Famiglietti, senior water scientist at the NASA Jet Propulsion Laboratory and a professor of Earth Systems Science at the University of California, Irvine. Ira Flatow, host of Science Friday, which you hear here on WFAE on Fridays at 2, and Bruce Henderson, environment reporter for the Charlotte Observer. Thank you all for the hour.
Thank you.